So we are in Psalms 37, just starting, and I'm using Mickey's slides, and if I had studied this a little more in depth before I got his slides, I probably would have changed the title of this. I don't perceive that Psalms 37 is about when anger rules. It's, in my opinion, it's more about hope or dedication versus anger or unrighteousness. It's an interesting psalm, one of the longer ones, I guess, 40 verses that we're going to study, though I guess Psalms 119 might be just a touch longer. So I have some introductory things that we want to go through, but the slides that Mickey has left, there's 32 of them. I doubt that I'm going to get very far into them, I hope. Just go through verses 1 through 9. Randy, do you have an inclination to read verses 1 through 9?
Sure.
If you would be so gracious.
Psalm 37, 1 through 9. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious toward wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil doing. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land.
Thank you. All right, so as we go through this, I have some introductory stuff. There is a commentary on the Book of Psalms that is in the Truth Commentary series, and they have an interesting introduction to Psalm 37. And so I just wanted to read that. It's a couple of paragraphs long. They said, and so this kind of, to me, is what defines what Psalm 37 is about. They say, David would often have seen the Lord's enemies flourishing temporarily while the righteous suffered hardship and persecution. In David's youth, Goliath openly defied the armies of the living God. Quote, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid, unquote, 1 Samuel 17:4 through 11, and also 23 and 24. David's anointing by Samuel did not lead him straight to the throne, but to a life hiding in wilderness regions with a few hundred supporters, whereas Saul, whom the Lord had rejected, continued to hold power in the palace and was able to muster an army of thousands. You can look at 1 Samuel 22 regarding that. Many years later, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel, so that again David was forced to flee into the wilderness while the wicked flourished in the palace with thousands of supporters. Yet in all these situations, David continued to trust in the Lord and was delivered, whereas the wicked soon perished and were cut off. I thought that's an excellent summary, I think, of Psalms 37. If we look at that and see how it sort of goes back and forth, you know, about don't be envious of the unrighteous because they'll be cut off, trust in the Lord, and so on. It just goes on through that. That's an interesting thing that is going on there. And when we look at the fact that David wrote this psalm and that he went through all these things that we've just mentioned, it should be encouraging to us to realize that he went through all this and still trusted in the Lord and didn't give up his faith in the Lord, even though it appeared that the unrighteous were prospering all over the place. Just makes me think of the phrase that the Lord sends the rain on the just and the unjust. So everybody gets it. A few just general introductory things. First of all, as we look at this psalm, it's interesting to note, and just sort of from an academic point of view, it's what's referred to as an acrostic psalm. or an acrostic poem. And in this, all 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet are used in sequential order to begin the sentences of the sections of this particular psalm. In these verses that we've just read, we have the first actual five letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph is in verses 1 and 2. Beit is in verses 3 and 4. Gimel is in verses 5 and 6. Dalet is in verse 7. And He is in verses 8 and 9. And so when we look at that, we understand that when this poem, song, was written, it was written in a style. I think perhaps that when we first started off studying the book of Psalms, what did we say that the purpose of the Psalms was? Anybody remember?
Well, they sang them.
They sang them.
And this would be a good way to memorize a psalm by having the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet in sequential order. You can remember the
Yeah. Right. That's right. These were songs many times that they would sing, perhaps on their way to the temple, or perhaps they would just sing them in daily life, like we might do with the psalms that we know, that we would sing to, encourage ourselves, to encourage others, to give praise to God, and so on.
Where they would sing the psalms.
Yeah.
Memorized.
So, you know, there's quite a number of psalms, are there not? What is it? 150, isn't it? Okay, I get mixed up with 119 because there's 176. 172 verses. Anyway, these are things that we might.
176, you were right.
Was I right? It was 176, okay. And so anything that we can do for psalms that we want to remember, then this is one way to help out. Because we need to remember that not only are these written for our admonition, for the admonition of everyone who's been around since they were written, there was a practical usage of them also. I mean, this was to encourage the people that were around at the time that were listening to these psalms, that heard these psalms as David put them forth and sang them, and then they were broadcast about by various people that were able to sing these songs also. It's important for us to realize that there's a reason why some of the psalms are written the way that they are. There are, according to the commentators that I read, 9 acrostic psalms. 9, 10, 25, 34, 37, 111, 112, 119, and 145. All of these use this particular arrangement. One of the commentators that I read said that, well, really 9 and 10 are supposed to be the same psalm, are supposed to be one psalm. There may be only 8, depending on how you want to look at it, but it really doesn't make any difference to us. Interestingly enough, there are acrostics also in Proverbs, in Lamentations, and in Nahum. And we ask then, as we already have, why acrostics? A commentator said perhaps it's for a sense of completeness, like saying that this is the A to the Z, this is the Alpha to the Omega, this is the Aleph to the Tav. It's a complete thing. There's a certain sense of that, perhaps, in here, of completeness about. And as the title in the English Standard Version says, he will not forsake his saints. And perhaps, as we've mentioned, it is to assist in memorization. Now, as we get into the slides that Mickey has generated, of course, I've changed all the quotations from American Standard or King James to English Standard because I feel that when we're speaking in a public forum like this, that we want the words to be understood by everybody. And so if we use something like the King James or the American Standard, sometimes it's difficult for people to understand what we're talking about. So I want to go to a version that is more American-friendly, you might say. And so in Psalms 37:1, where it says, "Fret not yourself because of evildoers," be not envious of wrongdoers. You will remember that Mickey made a comment at the end of class last week that I had an objection to the word fret, and I still do. It's interesting to note that when you run down the usages of the word fret in the entire Bible, there's like 6 usages of that word in English in the American Standard Version. Only in Psalms 37 is fret used in Psalms 37 and in one of the Proverbs, I believe it's Proverbs 27, is fret used to translate the Hebrew word chara. But the Hebrew word chara is used 90 times. One person says 92 times in the Old Testament. And so I looked through those 92 times. And this is the only place where it's used to use the word fret to talk about anger. And so given that that is not the definition, nor has it ever been in the English language of the word fret, that I find it highly confusing. Yet, all the major translations use the word fret. But you can go to some of the weird translations and they use some different terms. Others that have to do with worry or envy or things like how we would consider fret to be defined. But if you do an etymology on the word fret, it doesn't have anything to do with anger. And it doesn't even essentially, as far back as they go with some of these things, doesn't even come from the Greek or the Hebrew. So be that as it may, if we want to use fret to talk about anger, then fine, let's do that. We shall redefine the English word at this time. Randy?
I don't see where there's much difference in the meaning of in this verse. Do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be angry because of evildoers. It's basically saying don't let them bother you because they'll be taken care of.
Right.
They may prosper till they die, but they won't prosper after that.
Yeah, right.
We often use fret, though, to mean, like, to be anxious about something, to get yourself all worried rather than full-on anger.
Well, that's why I said that. I don't think it makes much difference in the meaning of this verse. It's saying don't let yourself be affected by it.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the Hebrew word chara, as we can see down at the bottom of the chart, to glow or grow warm figuratively, to blaze up of anger, zeal, jealousy, none of these have to do with any of the meaning of our English word fret, and not even close. For some reason, you know, the King James picked up on this or something like that, and people decide, well, this got to be the right one to use. And so they did. And so it just shocks me that the major versions use this word, even the NIV, which you would expect to, you know, come up with their own idea about things. We'll leave my discussion of the word fret. It is used 3 times in this text, in verses 1, 7, and 8. And it means, according to the definition of the Hebrew word chara, to become angry with. There's the other one in Proverbs. Proverbs 24, 19. Fret not yourself because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked. So if we were reading this in the English, we would say, don't worry about evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked. That's what we would say, because that's our definition of the word fret. The same thing up in Psalms 37:1. Don't worry or don't concern yourself because of evildoers, and don't be envious of wrongdoers. But the Hebrew is not saying that. It's saying don't be angry because of evildoers and not envious of wrongdoers. And actually, if we look at some of the context as we go through the 40 verses that are here in Psalms 37, we see really that that's what David, to a large extent, is talking about. In other words, if we look at what David's life was like, as I read in the introduction from the commentary, he had every reason to be angry with the things that were going on. But the only thing that he had to be angry with was to be angry at God. And we see that, I think, that in most instances he did not do that. There was an instance, for example, when Uzzah touched the ark and was killed. It said that David was angry. doesn't say necessarily that he was angry with God. It does say that he was angry, but I can't imagine who else he would be angry with. Randy?
The way it's used in verse 8 says, cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil doing. That word anger, what's that word in Hebrew, you know?
It's a different one. I think I have it. Let me see. I don't remember whether I actually wrote it down as an addition to the...
I'm just wondering if the translators wanted to separate the two words.
They are different words, and I think Mickey's got them further on down. There are other... Oh, there. No, it's not actually on the next page. It's on slide number 7, if you've got the outline. So, thumos... Porogimos, orgismos, and orge. If we look at slide 7, it says that orge is an anger which is an abiding and settled habit of the mind that is aroused under certain conditions. This is anger spoken of in the words, be ye angry. In other words, be ye angry and sin not. Trench says, under certain conditions, anger is a righteous passion. I believe orge is one, there's a comment here, that indicates that this is not just a passing thing. And I believe this is the word orge here. I'd have to...
Well, these are Greek words, though, aren't they? Definition of anger in the New Testament. So that's like...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. But, okay, I'm switching languages here to the wrong one. Similar to that, there is another word, notice down at the bottom of this slide that says chara. There's another one that is only slightly different in pronunciation from that. It's like kara or something like that. And it's another word for anger. And then I think there's a third word for anger also in the Hebrew that has to do, and they use the different ones here. So this one that's translated fret is universally translated fret in this one, in this psalm. So whenever the word kara is used, in the Hebrew, they translate it fret. So they're not mixing it up. And so it is, yes, in like in verse 8, it is a different word for anger. So, yeah, and so then down in 8b, then they use fret again. Yes, Jenny.
So I'm looking at an interlinear Bible. So the word for from anger is ak. And the definition is a nostril, nose, face, anger. And then fret is our kara, to burn or be kindled with anger. And then wrath, which is also in this same verse,
yes,
is kema, which is heat or rage.
Okay. The heat of rage type thing, yeah. Caroline.
The definition you've got there, to glow or grow warm, that makes me think of our word fury, and the, you know, fiery, that taken in that direction, which is like a really intense
true
anger.
Yeah.
If you go down and look at the usage of this word in the Old Testament, of the 90-92 times that it's used, it translated something like wrath and burning anger and things like that. It's just, you just go down through and it's anger, wrath, you know, and then fret. And you go, fret? Where did that come from? So it's much like the translation of the word for shepherd in the New Testament. Is it poimen, I think? And in every place that is used in the New Testament, except for one, it's translated shepherd. And in one place, it's translated pastor, so that the people that wrote the King James Version could keep their organization intact and say, there it is right there. It says pastor right there. Oh, yeah, but the word is shepherd everywhere else. Don't worry about that. You're not supposed to read the book anyway. And so we've looked at this, and once again, the Hebrew word used here, blaze up, and also zeal and jealousy is used also. You can see as how that would sort of fit in with that and the zealous kind of thing. We continue on with some more definitions of that. And so when we talk about fret, once again, in the Complete Word Study Dictionary. This is the one by Spiros Zodiades. A verb meaning to burn, to be kindled, to glow, to grow warm. Figuratively, it means to get angry or to become vexed. Of course, we use the word vexed all the time in our English language. So, or Thayer says to be hot, to be furious, to burn, to become angry, to be kindled. And if I were to use the English word threat in normal English, everyday usage, of course it would be to be furious, to burn, to become angry. No. But that's what we're looking at here. So we're looking at something that's pretty powerful. And so when it says to fret not yourself, or do not become angry because of evildoers, or be envious of wrongdoers, it's pretty powerful what we're talking about here. We're not just saying, nah, don't worry about them. It's don't be burned up with anger for them. And as we get along, we'll find out why that's the case. Let me see if I had. And then a few other definitions. Vine's Expository Dictionary says that to get angry, to be angry, he says it appears 92 times. I was only able to find 90. Refers to the burning of anger as in Jonah 4:1. You look at Jonah 4:1, it says, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. What in Jonah 4:1, what would it be that displeased Jonah?
4:1,
that would be
God.
When the plant died?
I think the plant is just a little bit further down. Okay. I think this is just when he's gotten to Nineveh, and he's gone over to the east side of it, and he's sitting up, you know, on the hill above Nineveh or whatever, and he's parked out there, and he's looking at Nineveh. So what displeased Jonah
was that God didn't destroy them.
Yeah, that God relented and said, okay, I'm not going to destroy you because you've repented, you know. And we see that the people were apparently very serious about their repentance.
He was mad because they repented.
Yes,
he was
mad over repentance.
And not forgiving.
Yes, and this word, I think, is used a couple of more times in chapter 4. When God says in the American Standard Version, are you right to be angry? And then later on, just a verse or two after that, he says, are you right to be angry over the gourd? Because God brought the gourd up to cover him in the sun, and then he killed it. And just to make a point to Jonah, which I'm not sure Jonah ever learned really very well. We kind of leave him there broiling in the sun, and then we kind of end the book of Jonah. So don't even know whether he made it back home. No. I know that his fish had already left. So anyway, as Vine says, refers to the burning angers in Jonah 4:1. In the causative stem, whatever that means, chara means to become heated with work, or with zeal for work, like Nehemiah 3:20. And Nehemiah 3:20, in the American Standard Version, it says, after him, we're talking about now the building of the wall, after him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, earnestly repaired another portion from the turning of the wall unto the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. But then also in the New American Standard Update, as you know, Randy, it says, after him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the doorway of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. So we see the idea of earnestly and zealously here. Interestingly enough, the English Standard Version does not use an adjective in this place at all. It just says they repaired. You go, oh. But all of the other major versions use an adjective here to indicate how they worked. So that's Vine's definition of that. Now, if we go, we've looked now at the Hebrew word of anger, and now we get to this slide that I mentioned earlier that talks about anger in the New Testament. And so here's those three words, thumos, paroxysmos, and orge. And so, also in the Greek, there are different definitions or different intensities, you might say, of anger. And so these are used for different reasons. So thumos, as Wust says, speaks of a turbulent commotion, the boiling agitation of the feelings, passion, anger forthwith boiling up and soon subsiding, which is forbidden in Ephesians 4:31, which says, let all bitterness and wrath, thumos, and anger, orge, and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice. So when this writer says that thumos is forbidden in Acts 4:31, indeed it is. It says, let it be put away from you. And then this paroxysmos, translated wrath, in Ephesians 4:26, which says, be angry, this is the word orge, which is the next word we look at, and do not sin, do not let the sun go down on your anger. And that's the paroxysmos. So it refers to anger that's accompanied by irritation, exasperation, embitterment. So when he says, don't let the sun go down in your anger, we're not talking quite so much as the turbulent, boiling thing that we're talking about with thumos. So it's a little milder, you might say. And then the third one is orge, an anger which is abiding, and which is an abiding and settled habit of the mind that is aroused under certain conditions. This is the anger spoken of in the words, be ye angry. Trench says, under certain conditions, anger is a righteous passion. He says that in Wust's Word Studies. But if we go back and look at then Ephesians, both 4:26 and Ephesians 4:31, the word orge for an abiding anger is in both of those verses. So in Ephesians 4:31, let all bitterness and wrath, thumos, and anger, orge, and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice in verse 31. And then in verse 26, be angry, orge, and do not sin. Do not let your sun go down on your anger, paroxysmos. So we see that there are qualities, you might say, of anger in the various words that are used, and so they are used for the purpose of further emphasizing something or making a nuance out of it that makes it more understandable for us. There are times, of course, when some of us display anger. I looked at this picture and I thought, I don't see any display of anger. It looks like a party, but be that as it may, we see displays of anger in politics, and we see that happens a lot. All you have to do is start talking politics in the office, and you'll see a lot of, what would you say, emotion come out, I think. Yes, maybe that's the word. But if we look at displays of anger for political reasons or something like that, in Proverbs, the 22nd chapter and verse 8, it says, whoever sows injustice will reap calamity, and the rod of his fury will fail. So once again, the same sort of lesson that's being taught here in Psalms 37 is taught there in Proverbs 22:8 about the fact that your fury will fail because it's not of God. As he says, our character has to be different. Our disposition has to be different than those people that are in the world. So a reference to James 1:20, for the anger, orge, of man does not produce the righteousness that God requires. And that's important for us to look at. Our anger doesn't produce righteousness. And that's what God wants. He wants righteousness. And so if we're angry all the time or some of the time, then we're not producing the righteousness that God requires. Randy.
I raised my hand to sin.
Yes, because you had changed glasses.
It wasn't in the passage, it was in the book. What I was going to say was, this might be one of the coming slides because I didn't look at it, but in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said,
Sermon on the Mount,
Matthew 5, 21, You've heard the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you, everyone who's angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. So, anger starts at one level and builds to another level and builds to another level and builds to another level.
Yeah.
And then I forgot exactly where it is in 1 John, but you know, if you're angry with your brother, you're already a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
God considers you a murderer if you're angry without cause.
Right.
So it's a matter of controlling our thoughts, and that's really what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. Is if you can't control your thoughts, you won't control your words or your actions.
Well,
you have to control your thoughts,
right,
first and foremost.
Yes. And we're admonished to do that, to control our thoughts. That's so important when it comes down to discussing anger. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of us have problems. I certainly do. It's being reactive to things. I didn't like this, and I didn't like it so much that I'm going to react right now. And it's going to be in a mostly negative way. But it's interesting to note your discussion there in, was it Matthew 5:21 and following, that it shows a buildup. And there are several instances in the New Testament where we see a buildup, where sin builds. You remember, where is that? It's there's three stages. And I know that it's on the left-hand page in the right-hand column of whatever book it's in. But it talks about lust when it conceives. I think that's where it starts off with. Bears this, and then so on.
Lust leads to sin, leads to death.
Lust leads to sin, leads to death. Right. That's what James says. But he didn't come up with a reference for us, but he will. The reference?
That's in the book of James.
James. Oh, it's in the book of James. James would know it's in James.
So James 1 or 2.
It's in James on the left-hand page on the right-hand column.
The bottom of the page.
Do what?
James 1:15.
Would you read that for us, that progression?
James 14.
But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death.
All right. So we've got the beginning, the conception, the growing, and the coming forth. Just the analogy of conception and birth. And that and the one there in Matthew is not the only places where it talks about the progression of sin or the progression of something. It's certainly worth paying attention to. So when we look at anger, we understand that our disposition has to be different from that of the world, and God doesn't like that if we're angry. Thus, the James 1:20. I guess the James 1:20 were pretty close to what I was talking about. No, this is the idea, though. In summary, it's let God take care of it, because I think that was the conundrum, you might say, that perhaps David had as he was talking in here. You know, why do the unrighteous get away with it, and so on? His faith is there. But I think that we can look at Psalms 37 throughout from 1 to 40 and realize that the message here is to let God take care of it. Leave it in his hands. Why is that? And so if we look at Romans the 12th chapter, it's actually 17 through 19 that I had down there. I think Mickey had 19, but
Really through 21.
You want to read that, Randy?
Sure. Romans 12:17-21. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. And if he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will reap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good.
Okay. So when we look at this statement about leave it in his hands and then ask why, The why is because vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And so it is his prerogative to take vengeance upon those who are due vengeance. And he will take care of that. And we need to step back and let him do that. It's much like, is it Matthew the 6th chapter that talks about the, you know, the flowers are pretty and all that sort of stuff, but they'll die and so on. That talks about letting God take over and do. Randy, you had a comment?
Just that verse, Romans 12:19, whenever I read that, I always have an image in my mind of God just moving you over. Get out of my way. I'll take care of it. Because, you know, vengeance is mine. I will repay. It's like, you're trying to do my job?
Right.
Yeah.
And,
who do you think you are?
It might not happen where we are aware of it. It might be their eternal destination.
Yeah.
Is where it happens.
Yeah. But you're not going to do God's job.
No.
It's God's job to take vengeance.
He does it so much better.
He does it better. That's right. And... you know, that's another difficult one. I mean, we look at that and we think, wow, I need to take care of this. You go, no, you need to let God take care of it. And we need to identify those, and we need to make sure that we take that mind of ours and train it in such a way that we will let God take care of things the way that he said that he would.
And it says, never take your own revenge.
Never take your own revenge.
Never is a very solid word.
It is. There's very, very little ambiguousness to never.
No, ambiguity.
Ambiguity. That's right. I made a new word. when we look at the summary of this, talking about the God taking care of it, and then, of course, just right back to our text about verse 2, it says, they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. God, once again, is taking care of it. We may not think that, and I think Carolyn's point is, I believe you just made that, is well taken, is that some of these may be eternal consequences. They won't be seen until it's time for eternity. So if they shall soon be cut down, if they'll wither like the grass or the green herb, that may be eternity that we're talking about there. And that's unfortunate, because then you don't have a chance to make up for it. And so the question then is, how do we deal with the ungodly? And the admonition here in Psalms 37 is, how do we deal with the ungodly? By living godly lives. And if we look at Titus, the second chapter, and verses 11 and 12, it says, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. Difficult for me to read this in the English Standard Version when I've read it for years in the American Standard. But the notice that it says that he brings salvation to all, and he trains us or teaches us to renounce ungodliness, to renounce worldly passions. And we have to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. That's something that's we've got to do. And why is that? What is this present age? Is it not, you might say, a training ground for the next age?
We don't want to bring on eternal consequences on ourselves that are adverse.
Right, because we've just talked in verses above this about these things could be eternal consequences. That's not what we want. We want the eternal consequences to be positive. Randy?
It's because the meaning of life, according to Solomon, is to fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man.
Yes, it is. That's right.
And if you don't recognize that, you can't be a child of God.
That's Ecclesiastes 12,
13,
I think. Yeah, right. Yeah. Fear God and keep his commandments. for this is the whole of man. The American Standard Version and some others provide duty in there, but it's a supplied word, and I'm not sure that it fits. I think it's much easier, much more reasonable to say that to keep his commandments is our whole. And that's really what we've been talking about.
A reason for being.
A reason for being, right. Something we shouldn't fret about.
Well, and if you look at it in the context of, what is it, Isaiah, I can't remember, where it talks about, we're clay made by the potter.
Oh, yeah.
Why does a potter make a clay pot? To serve the potter,
right? The clay pot serves the potter.
And that's why we were made, to serve the master.
Yes.
And we have those allusions also in the New Testament about how God created a pot, one to glory and one to dishonor and so on. And you think, well, then we're set, right? But it says also in another place that you can change the kind of pot that you are, the kind of vessel that you are, by doing the righteousness that God commands. And so we're to live godly lives. And so in these verses that we have, for example, in verse 3, we see that David says to trust in the Lord and to do good. And as a matter of fact, he says, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. The commentators that I read did not like the English Standard Version that said befriend faithfulness. Do you have the New American there, Randy? At the end of verse 3?
Cultivate faithfulness.
Yeah. And so it was a working thing. If you befriend, it's like it's sort of passive, yeah. But
there's a marginal reference that says feed securely on. Let's see, feed securely or feed on his faithfulness.
Okay, feed securely or feed on. Right. I think the commentators that I read talked about when we talk about trusting in the Lord and doing good, dwell in the land because the land is there to supply you with goodness, and so. We're talking about dwelling in God's land here. I'm not being admonished here as the American Standard or the English Standard seems to say, you know, befriending God, but rather understanding that I'm trusting in God to feed me as long as I follow with righteousness. And I think that's a bit more reasonable to think about. Trust in the Lord and do good. Shall I go on to the next slide? Or do I have like 30 seconds left?
We have like 8.
8 seconds? Okay. So we will start then next week with this slide here that talks about do good, dwell in the land, and delight yourself in the Lord, and continue on from there. Thank you for your comments.